Welcome back to A Bit of Fun with Emily. It's me, your host, Emily. I am glad you're here. This little podcast is a safe space to talk about the movies we love, the good and the bad, acknowledging their issues and celebrating their successes with a healthy dose of nostalgia thrown in for good measure. And because I'm a librarian by day and don't need an excuse to talk books, at the end of our conversation, I'll give you a few book recommendations you might like if this movie sounds like your cup of tea. Before we dive into today's movie pick, 1986's Crocodile Dundee, a quick ask. If you like the podcast and want a free and super easy way to support what I do, please consider rating or reviewing the podcast wherever you listen. You can also just share the podcast with someone or someones you know that you think might enjoy the fun as well. Word of mouth marketing, I would be ever so appreciative. So I've been on the struggle bus with the podcast. I haven't had that pull, that drive to talk about any movie in particular. I sat through most of last week just trying to figure out what I was going to talk about this week. I reached out to the weirdos. They've been on the podcast before. Watson, Jessica, Valerie said, hey, what should I talk about? They gave me some ideas, but just nothing was really calling to me at all, which was frustrating. And I'm also kind of in the middle of a digital detox. I'm trying not to watch TV or movies at least 3 times a week. I'm only allowing myself about 30 minutes of social media at a day, which has been really good for me. I have needed that. I was, to be completely honest, the social media aspect was because I am extremely tired of hearing about Taylor Swift. That's the most pathetic reason to get off of social media. But I found that I was getting weirdly, irrationally angry about the whole thing. I'm over her. She's an amazing genius businesswoman. I admit and acknowledge her talent and celebrate her successes, but I just don't want to hear about it anymore. I don't want to see her face. I don't want to talk about who she's dating. I don't think there's anything deeply hidden in the lyrics of her songs that personally I feel all sound the same, but I know some people just absolutely adore her, which is awesome, but I am over it. And so I've taken myself for the most part off of social media. I hop on to make sure nobody's messaged me. And I also hop on because I follow a lot of farms and I want to make sure that those animals are okay. This is also a problem. So I'm just kind of taking a breath and I've felt better. I have felt really good. So I'm probably going to continue it a little bit, but I think because I've been out of the digital space a little more that I've just not been craving it. And so I had a hard time. And so then all of a sudden it came to me. I did watch a TV show or a movie. I wish I hadn't. It wasn't great. That Anyone But You with Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney. Again, not my favorite. It was it was not great, but it was set in Australia. And as I'm watching it, I was like, you know what? I know what I can talk about. I'm going to talk about Crocodile Dundee. Now, does Anyone But You in any way resemble Crocodile Dundee? No. No, it does not. Which do I think is the better movie? Crocodile Dundee. So that is what we are talking about today. I'm kind of excited about it. It's a lot like Inner Space for me. Way back in, I don't know, episode 120-something, I think, that I talked about Inner Space with Dennis Quaid. That is that movie from my childhood that I've just has always kind of been there and I've always kind of loved. I mean... We popped this in a couple of years ago on a family vacation. My whole family went to Florida and we were spending time together and they're like, what do you want to watch? And we put in Crocodile Dundee. I don't know why, but I was happy we did because it holds up fairly well, but we'll talk about it. So that is what we are discussing today. Before we dive into the movie context, though, let's listen to the trailer.
He was raised in the land down under, where a man thinks on his feet, speaks with his fists, and lives by his wits.
Two beers, all right? One for me,
one for me, mate.
A legendary figure about to encounter a world more treacherous than any he has ever known.
G'day. Dick Dundee from Australia. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Just came down for a couple of days. Probably see you around.
Bye.
This your first trip to New York? First trip anywhere.
Well, we might just have to give you one for free.
Yeah. One more.
How are you finding New York?
A bit of a lunatic, is all I'm for. That's why I love it, because I fit right in.
G'day.
Hello.
Sorry. G'day. Look.
Well, if you can manage, Walt, I'd like to stay a while.
Wouldn't have anything to do with a certain lady writer, would it?
Paramount Pictures presents...
Your pal, Senor Meek.
Paul Hogan.
Hey, my man, what's that?
Where?
As Crocodile Dundee.
You got a light, buddy?
Yeah, sure, kid.
And your wallet.
He's got a knife.
That's not a knife. That's a knife.
Crocodile Dundee.
There's not a lot of production information, which always makes me sad. You know that, but we're going to get into it a little bit. So Crocodile Dundee was directed by Peter Faman. Faman was a producer of a few Australian TV shows in the 80s. Of course, I knew none of the names of the shows, which is unsurprising because I don't know anything about Australian pop culture except for Bluey. He would go on to direct Crocodile Dundee and Dutch, a movie starring Ed O'Neill. I remember the title and I remember Ed O'Neill, but I'm not entirely sure if I've ever seen that movie, and I don't really feel like I need to. He also produced Fern Gully. And those are the only things I recognize in his filmography. Dundee was written by Paul Hogan, Ken Shady, and John Cornell. Hogan is, of course, the star of the film, known for the Dundee series, Almost an Angel, Lightning Jack, and Flipper, starring Elijah Wood. It looks like Shady and Cornell are just kind of some of Hogan's creative buddies. There's nothing else on their filmography except the stuff that he has worked on with them. So Hogan got the idea for the movie during a trip to New York. He's wandering around and started to think about what it would be like if an Australian bushman visited the Big Apple. Quote, "There's a lot about Dundee that we all think we're like, but we're not because we live in Sydney. He's a mythical outback Australian who does exist in part, the frontiersman who walks through the bush, picking up snakes and throwing them aside, living off the land, who can ride horses and chop down trees and has that simple, friendly, laid-back philosophy. It's like the image the Americans have of us, so why not give them one? We've always been desperately short of folk heroes in this country. Ned Kelly is pathetic. So are the Bushrangers." So that is why he kind of came up with this movie. Principal photography began in July of 1985. The first scenes were filmed in the small town of McKinley in Queensland. I thought it was a set, but apparently it was not. It was a real town, which I find fascinating. Production decided to shoot in Kakadu National Park at the end of the dry season, since crocodiles were less active in the filming locations. I'll have a lot to say about that later. 6 weeks of filming were spent working out of Jaja. They have some weird names. An abandoned uranium mining camp in Kakadu National Park in the Northern Territory, with an additional week in Cloncurry. There was a further 6 weeks filming in New York City. Filming wrapped in October of 1985. When the filming finished, Hogan said he expected it would make millions of dollars around the world. Hogan also said of the film, quote, "I'm planning for it to be Australia's first proper movie. I don't think we've had one yet. Not a real general public successful entertaining movie." Crocodile Dundee was offered to 20th Century Fox and Warner Brothers for North American release before Paramount picked it up for $6 million. So that's all the production notes that I really have for this one. It, of course, stars Paul Hogan as Michael J. Crocodile Dundee, Linda Kozlowski as Sue Charlton. She is the journalist, about the only lady in the movie. John Melion as Walter. He is probably my favorite character, and he's in it very, very little. So I really like him. David Gulpil as Neville Nev Bell. Mark Blum as Richard Mason. Michael Lombard as Sam Charlton. so that must be Sue's dad. Reginald Velt Johnson as Gus. Terry Gill as Duffy. Steve Rackman as Donk. And Gary Skilton as Nugget. And I just left those last two in there. They're in it just a short bit, but there are characters named Duffy, Donk, and Nugget in this movie. And I think that is fantastic. Another reason to love the film. Crocodile Dundee opened with a record $2 million, a little over $2 million in Australia in its first week. It went on to gross $47.7 million in Australia at the box office and was the highest grossing film of all time in Australia after 11 weeks, surpassing E.T. the Extraterrestrial. A number of minor changes were made to the film for the U.S. release, where it was released theatrically by Paramount Pictures in September of 86. The film debuted at number one, grossing $8 million in its opening weekend in the U.S., and it remained at number one for 9 weeks. It ended up grossing $174.8 million at the U.S. and Canadian box office. So Paul Hogan was right. It made millions and millions of dollars, and it was the second highest grossing film that year for both the studio and the U.S. box office. Box Office Mojo estimates that the film sold over 46 million tickets in North America. I just love that. It's so fantastic. The film was a sleeper hit, grossing $328 million and surpassing Mad Max 2 as the highest grossing Australian film at the worldwide box office. That is Crocodile Dundee, guys. Crocodile Dundee. Of course, this is in the 1980s, but still. So what else came out that year? As we mentioned, it was number two in the box office in the U.S. in the 86. So Top Gun was number one with $176.7 million. Number three was Platoon. Then came The Karate Kid Part Two, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, Back to School, which that's not ringing a bell for me. Aliens, The Golden Child, Ruthless People, and rounding out the top 10, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Crocodile Dundee made more at the box office than Ferris Bueller's Day Off. The Rotten Tomatoes score is absolutely wild when we look at reviews. There's a 30-point difference between the critic score and the audience score, and it did not go the way that I thought it would. 89% for the critics and 59% audience score, which is just wild. The consensus reads, infectiously easygoing charm and a leading man in the role he was born to help Crocodile Dundee make the most of its familiar fish out of water premise. This one also, of course, caught the attention of Roger Ebert. Not really in a good way, though. He only gave it 2 stars out of 4. Is that what he usually does? Ebert said they made this kind of movie better in the 30s when audiences were more accustomed to the reliable old storyline. Aggressive female newspaper reporter from the New York tracks down legendary wilderness guide in the outback is saved from crocodiles, falls in love, asks living legend to return with her to New York to meet her millionaire daddy and her fiance, a wimp. Clark Gable and Carol Lombard could have made this movie. Maybe they did. It does feel a little bit like It Happened One Night, which is a fantastic movie. He goes on to say, Crocodile Dundee knows the words to this story, but not the music. All of the cliches are in the right places. Most of the gags pay off, and there are moments of real amusement as the Australian cowboy wanders around Manhattan as a naive sightseer. The problem is that there's not one moment of chemistry between the two actors. Paul Hogan as Crocodile Dundee and Linda Kozlowski as the clever little rich girl. The movie feels curiously machine-made, as if they had all the right ingredients and simply forgot to add the animal magnetism. So, sounds like Roger was just really looking for a love story. He was in the mood for a love story. He's not wrong. I don't see these two together. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I find her incredibly annoying, Sue, most of the time. But I guess we can talk about that here in a minute. So, a quick summary, in case you're unfamiliar with Crocodile Dundee, which is a shame. If you are, you should definitely head to your local public library and check this one out. It is a fun, good time. So a New York journalist, she hears about an Australian man who lives in the bush and nearly died after a crocodile attack, but somehow he kind of survived alone for days. And apparently she was already in the area doing another story somewhere. So she decides that she's going to find him and get his full story. So she heads out into the middle of nowhere, Australia, and is met by this very sweet, kind, unassuming man named Walter, who just so happens to be the business associate of Mick Dundee, the infamous man she's looking for. And Walter's like, no, it's going to be great. You're going to go on a walkabout with Mick. It's going to be good. He's just so sweet. And he has this little outfit on. It's kind of like the stereotype of the adventurer who's going to trek out into the wilderness. He's got shorts on. I don't know. It's a great, I just love Walter. He's in the second one too, which I appreciate, but I just wish there was more Walter. So it becomes extremely evident that the story of Mick has been, I don't know, greatly exaggerated, at least when it comes to the crocodile attack. So he shows up in town. He's going to take her out into the outback. So she heads out on a walkabout with him for a couple days, and the stories kind of get bigger as he tells them. But he also kind of lives up to the legend a little bit. He's this wild man, comfortable in the wilderness, and he's kind of unafraid of danger. He's a bit sexist, which ticks off the hardened New York city girl. So at one point she decides, you know, I'm just going to go off on my own. I'm going to meet you at this place that you say we're going to hike to today. I can do this. I don't need you. I'm tough. She almost gets herself attacked by a crocodile. She almost dies, but Mick, being Mick, is on her tail the whole time, kind of sneaking around behind her in case she runs into any trouble, which she obviously does. So they survive out in the outback together. They end up meeting back up with Walter, and Sue decides, the journalist decides, that it would be super fun to bring Mick back to New York with her, you know, the fish out of water kind of scenario. So she brings this bushman to the big city. I don't honestly know why. She's continuing her story with him, but it was much more interesting in Australia. It actually kind of seems kind of cruel to me a little bit. There's not a lot of plan for him. She sticks him in a hotel room, kind of leaves him by himself. She has this really just jackass of a boyfriend, which is obnoxious. You get really tired of him. Mick explores the city as best as he can. He's learning a lot. I mean, he had watched TV one time before he gets to the big city, and now he's got a TV in his hotel room. But then you see him learning a lot out on the streets. So he kind of starts to fall for Sue. Sue gets engaged to the awful boyfriend, but then decides not to marry the awful boyfriend because apparently she has feelings for Mick too, even though, as Roger Ebert pointed out, there was no chemistry. And so Mick decides he's going to go walk about in the U.S. And so he heads downtown to try to find the subway to take him to Union Station, Grand Central Station. And she comes running after him. And there's a fun scene at the very end where there's kind of a relay of people in the subway station trying to get him a message from Sue, who's on a very crowded platform trying to find him. And they kiss at the end. And that is the end of the movie. It's good. I've always liked that scene, her yelling, and then he ends up like walking on everybody's heads to get to her, and everybody seems cool with that because he's Australian. He gets away with a lot because he's Australian. So what are my initial thoughts about the movie? There's something about the music that I absolutely love. It's adventurous. The soundtrack is just very interesting because it's got this adventurous tone, like, hey, you're about to go into the outback. But it also leaves you with the sense that there's something waiting for you around the corner, like something hiding in the bushes. Not in a scary horror movie kind of way, but like just a cautious, hey, there's wildlife that's going to kill you in Australia kind of way. And it actually works really well for New York City too, because Mick finds out that there's a lot of kind of dangerous things. Not that he's afraid of the dangerous things in New York City, but there's some of that as well out there. So in Australia, they meet up in this town called Walkabout Creek, which reminds me a lot of Perfection, Nevada in Tremors. And I know I've been talking about Tremors a lot. We did a whole episode on Tremors. I then started to ask just random people that I was coming across that I didn't know. It wasn't like I was grabbing strangers. Like, what are your thoughts on Tremors? What are your thoughts on Tremors? And I'm reading this book. It's not out yet. It's being released in June. The author is going to be coming to my library in October, so I wanted to make sure to go ahead and read this book. And at one point, the girl in the book is talking about how she connected with a former boyfriend. And she's like, well, we had the same fun taste in 90s movies. We both really loved Tremors and Twister. And I'm like, man, Tremors is everywhere. This is fantastic. But Walkabout Creek kind of reminded me of Perfection. It's a town that just doesn't seem like it should exist. This town has a little more action than Perfection, definitely has a few more people, has a really rowdy bar, But it leaves you wondering why it's there, who chose that particular place for this particular town, and how it sustains itself. It seems, at least with Walkabout Creek, that it's kind of a meeting place for people who want to go hunting, which I have a lot of questions about that too. Can people just go out into the outback and hunt? I mean, there's some conversation about poaching in the movie, which poaching would be a no-no, absolutely. But it's like, is that a thing? What do people hunt for in Australia? Are there turkeys there? Is there a deer of some sort? Or is a kangaroo like a deer where they have to occasionally go in and kind of decrease the population by a hunt? But kangaroos are scary, which leads me to my next point. Australia is scary. I'll get to that in a second. I know there were, as I was reading some of the interesting tidbits, there were some criticisms that the movie wrongly stereotypes Australians kind of as redneck heathens. It kind of made me think of, I'm sorry if you're listening from Kentucky, but that kind of stereotype that we have of kind of a redneck hick here in the States. And so that Australians are kind of prone to drinking and fighting. And I'm sure that that's true, that that is kind of a bad stereotype. But you also wonder about the people who choose to live out there in terrain that seems to have been, again, made specifically to kill people. I think it would take some incredibly brave, but also they all have to be a little off their rocker, right? I mean, it's dangerous out there and it's remote and you have to learn to fend for yourself. So I would assume there's a lot of drinking. So that kind of makes sense. It's just kind of interesting to think about people in Sydney. No, I don't think people in Sydney behave or act this way. Hopefully they have some of the same vocabulary and lingo, because it cracks me up listening to Australians really get going. But again, that is just the stereotype that American pop culture has created about America or Australians. But I can't help but think that maybe people out in the outback are just a little nuts, because there is absolutely no amount of money you could pay me to go on a walkabout in Australia. And I mean that sincerely. I'm not just saying, there is zero amount of money that you could give me to send me out into the outback in Australia. My cousin came back from Australia. I was like, hey, I saw your Instagram post. Like, how are you okay? He goes, what do you mean? I was like, how did you survive in Australia? He goes, it's not that bad. I was like, oh, I believe it is. I believe it. I mean, the size of the spiders and the snakes everywhere. There's a scene in the movie where they're about to go camping on the first night. No tent or anything. They're just going to sleep on the ground, which I know people do that. I understand people do that. But she's sitting on this downed log and they're just having a nice chat. And all of a sudden he gets up and grabs this poisonous snake from behind her, and he ends up killing it, which I have questions about that too. And he just tosses it, and she seems a little scared, a little petrified, but then she just climbs into a sleeping bag and goes to sleep. There is no chance I would be asleep. I don't know. I would be keeping so fiercely guarded. No chance I would be asleep. There is also, and I'm sure I've talked about it on the podcast here, there is this video on YouTube about this house that has all these glass windows, and this very large kangaroo goes up to the glass and starts, and he flexes. Male kangaroos that are really big, when they flex, they look like bodybuilders. They are just made of muscle, and he starts to chest butt this window. And then he gets kind of angry that it's not breaking, and he takes his claws that are so big and scary and just starts scraping them down the glass. And that is a horror show. And I don't know who would live there. Even they say koalas are mean and grouchy and can attack you. They are little danger floofs. You would want to hug that thing. No, you should not hug that thing. But it just, Australia scares me. The ocean around Australia scares me. It feels like there's a lot of dangerous things in the ocean there too. I just feel like Australia, for the most part, was put on the planet to kill people. And I think that the Australian people are very brave, that they just kind of go about their life with all of those things around them, and they maybe notice but don't seem to care. I don't understand how they do that. And it's been a while since I watched this movie, and I think I assumed that Mick Dundee was a little bit more of a conservationist, that he wanted to protect the land and the people on it and the animals on it. But he just snapped that snake's neck and tossed it out, you know, just away from the fire from where they were sitting, just killed it. But I think maybe I was watching through modern eyes and expecting Mick to behave more like Steve Irwin. And I was a big Steve Irwin fan. It was a very, very sad day when he passed away. And I have been following the family since. And it just amazes me the poise and the confidence and the perseverance that that family has and the passion that they have, that it wasn't just his passion. It became their passion too. And what they are doing for conservation across the world is just pretty amazing. But I think I assumed Mick was like that. And he was not like that. He was just killing things, just killing crocodiles left and right. And he's killing snakes. And at one point, Sue convinces him, hey, you've got to stop these poachers. Do something. And he takes a kangaroo that has been shot and puts it on his head and then shoots his own gun at the poachers, and they get scared because it looks like a kangaroo is shooting at them. And that's just another reason why this movie is fun and you should watch it. And that is all of my thoughts. I don't like him in New York City. I think it's, like I said, just a little bit cruel. You're laughing at somebody who clearly doesn't know. It's not a willful ignorance. It's just he did not have that stuff around him. And I know it's meant to be fun, and there's parts of it that's fun, like when they get mugged and this guy's got this little knife, and she's like, you give him your wallet, he's got a knife. And he's like, that's not a knife, this is a knife. And he pulls out this just giant hunting knife that he has. I mean, there's good moments to it, but it's, I don't know, he doesn't need to be there. Why does he need to be in New York? I think it would have been more fun to have her out in the outback more. Personally, myself. A few interesting tidbits about the movie. The Sydney Harbor Bridge is shown in the beginning of the movie from the hotel window while Sue is on the phone to New York. Paul Hogan helped paint this bridge before he started his life as an actor and was said to have kept his co-workers laughing a good bit of the time. There were steel, rubber, and aluminum versions of the Bowie knife on set. Hogan kept one of the steel knives after the movie and promised never to sell it. David Goldplill, there's a lot of I's and L's in his name, I do apologize, who played Nev, choreographed the traditional Aboriginal dance shown in the movie. He's one of the most famous and acclaimed tribal dancers of all time in Australia. This picture was one of 50 Australian films selected for preservation as part of the National Film and Sound Archive of Australia's Kodak AtLab Cinema Collection Restoration Project. And this little tidbit killed me. Melissa Joan Hart, you know, Sabrina, the Teenage Witch, which originally appeared in the film as a little girl in Central Park who cuts her knee and gets healed, like Mick comes to help her. The scene was shot, but ultimately deleted. So there's a shot out there with Melissa Joan Hart and Paul Hogan together. Does this movie hold up? It does. There's a few parts that are a little squidgy that may not be politically correct at the time. I was actually having a conversation with one of the weirdos today about it. In the movie, there are two instances where Mick is introduced to trans individuals, and he appears to not have any clue what that is. He's the first time it happens to be a prostitute who is trying to get Mick to, like, Mick is like, oh, she's flirting with me, and is trying to get him to leave with her, and somebody finally is like, hey, that's a guy. And Mick then grabs this individual to check, and then he's kind of startled. And it happens again, and it's supposed to be funny because now he's at this really posh party. He's being introduced to all of these just really rich, well-known individuals within the city who are kind of in the echelons of society, apparently. And there's an individual that he is introduced to there, who has a very deep voice, dressed as a woman, but has, you know, the deep tenor of a man, and grabs that individual too, which she ends up behaving as if it's flirting, which is kind of interesting. So it makes you like, ooh, I don't know. But at the same time, the conversation I was having is like, if you were living in the outback, had no access to televisions and radios, and you just, that wasn't a part of the culture there, or you did not know anybody in the culture who, you know, in your community that was trans, and that you had not heard of it, it would be interesting. Like, you would have, like, wait, what are we talking about? What is going on? So it didn't seem overly inappropriate, because in the context of Mick and the Outback and that type of thing, but also just a little weird and a little uncomfortable at the same time. So that's about the only thing. There's a lot of sexist things in the movie, but they call it out. So Sue calls him out on it. So you don't really think a lot about that either. It's not like she lets him get away with, you know, telling her that because she's a woman, she can't do things. So I do appreciate that too. So overall, the movie holds up pretty well, I guess. One of my other favorite fun facts that probably nobody else would care about but me, but there's a, the guy that stands on the curb and helps people get out of their cars and helps them with their luggage at this hotel. What is that called? I don't know what that's called. Bellboy, like a bellboy. He is the laundry guy in the movie Annie, who helps Annie escape from the orphanage in his laundry basket. Nobody else cares about that but me, but I care very deeply about that little fact. So there we go. As for movie night recommendations, you could absolutely make it a double feature. Just go all in with Mick Dundee, immediately pop in the sequel, which is a lot of fun. Not as good as the original, not as good as this one, but also a lot of fun. So you could do that. Or you could also stay in Australia, but maybe go a different direction. And I've got two suggestions. You could do Quigley Down Under. Came out in 1990. Sharpshooter Matt Quigley is hired from Wyoming by an Australian rancher paying a very high price. But when Quigley arrives down under, all is not as it seems. It does have Alan Rickman in it. It has Tom Selleck as Quigley. It's got that humor. It's got some adventure in it. So you could go that direction. You could also try 1982's The Man from Snowy River, set in the 1880s Australia. After young Jim Craig's father dies, he takes a job at the Harrison Cattle Ranch, where he is forced to become a man. There's not a lot of plot in that one, but it's also just kind of fun. You get to listen to the Australian accents. There's a lot of horse riding. There's a very dramatic ending where he is like driving horses down a steep mountain and you don't know how he's doing that. So you could go one of those directions, Quigley Down Under or The Man from Snowy River, or you can just pop in the sequel and just keep it going with Mick Dundee all night. And book recommendation. I might recommend one of my favorite traps. So yeah, that's about the only way you can go, I think. I've not read a book that I have enjoyed that is actually set in Australia, which is kind of crazy. I've read some books by Australian authors, and they have a very unique voice. I don't quite know how to describe it. It's a little hard to get into, and I think it's very interesting when you read books written, English books, so it's not even a translation, written by other cultures, there's just a cadence that's different. And I have never been really able to get into the cadence of those books. So I'm going to go with one of my favorite travel writers, Bill Bryson. He wrote In a Sunburned Country. And the little summary is, it's the driest, flattest, hottest, most infertile, and climactically aggressive of all the inhabited continents. And still, Australia teems with life, a large portion of it quite deadly. In fact, Australia has more things that can kill you in a very nasty way than anywhere else. Ignoring such dangers and yet curiously obsessed by them, Bill Bryson journeyed to Australia and promptly fell in love with the country. And who can blame him? The people are cheerful, extroverted, quick-witted, and unfailingly obliging. Their cities are safe and clean and nearly always built on water. The food is excellent, the beer is cold, and the sun nearly always shines. Life doesn't get much better than this. I'm glad Bill Bryson liked it, but I think I would die very quickly, or I would just be crying all the time. Just wanting to go home. How can something so deadly be right there? But then you go to New Zealand, which is not that far away, and there's no snakes on New Zealand. There's no snakes. Snakes are my greatest fear on the planet. I am absolutely petrified, and not in a fun, haha, let's tease her about it way. No, full on panic attack. Would, you know, not be able to breathe if one comes near me. I'd skip them at the zoo. I actively close my eyes if they're ever on screen. I just don't, I don't like them. I'm scared. I'm scared of them. So I would love to go to a place where that is just not a worry. I've been to Ireland. I just walked through the grass like I had no care in the world because I knew there were no snakes there. I would love to go to New Zealand and experience that as well. I am getting more terrified of them as I get older, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's not like there's more out there than there were when I was little. And I'm not as actively in those places like I was when I was little, that I would be around them more. But I am terrified of them. And so now when I go to like national parks, I can barely walk down a trail. It is really bad. We did this wonderful trip up to South Dakota, and we kind of did a few parts of the Oregon Trail. And there was one park we went to, I think it was a national park or a national monument. And every 3 feet, there was a sign that said, beware rattlesnakes. And I started to go into full panic attack. This was just a handful of years ago. And my mom was finally like, let's get back to the car. You're going to hyperventilate. I need to get you back to the car. Did I ever see a snake? No. But why did they have to put so many signs? I mean, they just built upon that fear until it became so overwhelming. I couldn't take it. So that is how I feel I would be in Australia. But I can watch movies. I can enjoy Crocodile Dundee till I was going to say the cows come home, but that feels weird. He does make a cow kind of buffalo go to sleep, which is fun too. He has these magical powers, Crocodile Dundee. Ugh, just watch the film. You're going to like it. You're going to enjoy it. You're going to be like, Emily, this was kind of goofy. Why did you suggest this? And then you're going to be like, but it was kind of fun. I kind of had a good time. And that is all I have for you today. Thank you so much for listening. Really, it is so appreciated. If you haven't already, I hope you subscribe so that we can keep going on this journey together. And if you've got the time, it would be awesome if you could rate or review, like I mentioned at the top, other individuals who like just really random conversations about pop culture with someone who doesn't really know what they're talking about, but apparently has a lot of opinions about those things. Well, those folks can join in on the fun as well. And if you hit subscribe, it just automatically shows up in your feed. You're never going to miss an episode of A Bit of Fun with Emily because it's just going to be there. And that's awesome. If you would like to share the podcast, that would be awesome too. You can follow me on Instagram and Facebook as A Bit of Fun with Emily. Go have yourself a bit of fun today. And I'll see you next time.